Jason Hartley spent a year with his boots on the ground in Iraq, serving as an infantryman in the United States Army. Like other infantrymen, he was keeping an eye on what was going on in his life and trying to remember as much of it as possible. But he decided to do it in a different way than many others did. He decided to blog about it. Kept a almost daily diary about his adventures before going off to war and while he was at war in Iraq. The United States military did not look kindly upon Jason doing that blog while he was at war, and they clamped down on him pretty hard and, in fact, shut down his blog and then cracked down on him before he was allowed to leave the military. Now that he's out, he has taken all of those blog entries and turned them into a book called A Year on the Ground in Iraq, Just Another Soldier. Jason Hartley, welcome to the Paul Harris Show.
Hey, thanks, Paul.
So when you left the Army, had you been demoted?
Actually, you know what? I'm still in the Army. I'm still in the New York National Guard. But once we came off active duty, you know, once we went back to the once-a-month thing, I was actually given what they call steel grade Article 15, and I was demoted and fined $1,000.
Did you have a laptop with you that you were blogging on, or were there places in Iraq that you could stop and, you know, internet cafes? How did you do that?
I had a laptop. As pretty much, you know, I would say about 90% or more even of the soldiers that were in Iraq in my platoon and my company had laptops. So I did all the writing on my laptop, and then I would usually head down to one of the cafes and upload the story, you know, to the blog or email it out.
How long had you been in Iraq before somebody said, knock that off?
Well, it was actually twice when I had gotten in trouble. We were just about to leave for Iraq, and we were like about a week away from heading for Kuwait, and my commander found my blog, and he asked me to shut it down. I continued to write while I was there, but I kind of did it under the radar. I emailed my stories out to about 1,500 people who wanted to be maintained on a mailing list, and then at the end of the deployment, I put the blog back up online, and that's when I got into the trouble that got me demoted and fined.
Now, since you're still in the Guard, did you have to clear the book with anybody?
You know, I didn't, and I didn't even ask. It was something that needed to be done, so I'm kind of I hope I don't get in trouble for what I wrote, but I don't think that it was really an issue because I didn't have a security clearance that would require me, you know, going before, you know, putting the book before civil affairs or to anyone like that. And mostly it's just a bunch of, like, you know, me being introspective. I think that for the most part there's not, I didn't write inside the wire. This is not, you know, I'm not a part of, like, an intelligence community that would require that kind of scrutiny on the book's content, I don't think.
And when you were writing, you weren't giving away positions and strategies and all that sort of stuff?
No, not at all. I mean, most of what I wrote, too, I didn't want it to be news because I wanted to avoid that being a problem. So mostly what I would do is that the stories would be a little bit old by the time I actually published them. That was kind of by design because I didn't want it to be, I guess, what you could call actionable intelligence, you know, to the enemy, describing anything we had done recently, like, you know, damage that they might have inflicted upon us. I was more concerned about the experience in general of being a soldier in Iraq and not so much about being a news source.
One of the big news stories today is a truck bomb in Baghdad, and we have at least 10 people dead. Some guy with a concrete truck who had tried to get through a fence and couldn't get through and eventually just decided to hit the button and blow himself and his explosives up and has taken out several lives. Was that a regular part of your life there in Iraq for 11 or 12 months?
Car bombs were, I wouldn't say regular, but we definitely encountered probably a good maybe 5 or 6 in the 11 months that I was there. Usually, you know, sometimes they were effective. They actually blew up part of the city council building in the town where I worked at one point. Sometimes they weren't able to get past our traffic control points and would just kind of say screw it and blow themselves up, right, you know, do the most damage they could at that point. But it was we definitely dealt with a few car bombs in the time we were there.
Did you also have to deal with IEDs?
IEDs were a daily occurrence, basically. That was our biggest threat, was IEDs. We had a segment of the, what we call the major supply route that we had to patrol and try to clear. And, yeah, IEDs were a huge part of our lives and running counter-IED missions and trying to not get killed by IEDs. But, yeah, that was our biggest danger.
Did you worry about that everywhere you drove?
Everywhere, yeah, because they were pretty good about sort of rotating the areas where they would employ the IEDs. They generally would choose different times of day. It was they did a pretty good job of it being fairly random. And yeah, that was something we had to stay very alert for all the time. And they got better at hiding them, too, in the time that we were there.
You joined the Army National Guard when you were 17 years old. You were a weekend warrior for 13 years until getting called up into active duty in 2003 and then doing your 11 months on the ground in Iraq. You trained to be a soldier, but you kind of ended up being a cop, didn't you?
Yeah, that was a big problem in some ways because it was difficult to make that shift. We're all infantrymen. The training that takes place in the U.S. infantry is still based primarily off of off the Cold War, where it's very much it's a force on force, where we train to fight other soldiers in the woods, essentially, and that's the way our tactics. That's where the manuals were written. So you had to be in Iraq, where one, we're fighting an insurgency, so we're not fighting a uniformed enemy. That's not following typical conventional warfare tactics. And two, a lot of what we're doing too is being a police officer, essentially dealing with detainees or raiding homes or just trying to keep an eye on things. And sometimes we did work directly with the Iraqi police, and it was sometimes difficult to shift because all we want to be doing is basically shooting things and blowing things up. But that's not the kind of operations we were typically doing. We had to do. We were trying to keep the peace or sustain things or, you know, patrol the road. So, yeah, at times it was difficult to do that shift.
You mentioned the Iraqi police. In your time there, and I know you haven't been there for over a year now, what was the status of the Iraqi police, the Iraqi army? Did you ever have confidence that we could leave and let these guys take control?
The short answer to that question is no. I mean, in the area where I was, we spent a lot of time, as we should have, training up the Iraqi National Guard. They were called the ICDC at first, then it became the Iraqi National Guard. Now they're called the Iraqi Army. It's the same guys, basically, just they keep on kind of getting a facelift. But we trained a lot of these guys, and they were pretty darn good. By the time that we left, we had a decent number, a handful of platoons of these Iraqi National Guardsmen who were decent. Whether or not they could actually do things on their own, I'd say not quite yet. But they made some decent progress. The Iraqi police, on the other hand, and I can only speak for the area where I was, we didn't train them. They were their own organization. We interacted with them a lot of the time. But they were, to be completely honest, fairly corrupt, and at times were as much of a liability as anything was. We kind of had to, you know, we had to work with them, but at the same time sort of keep an eye on them and make sure they, you know, stayed as straight as they could.
Does it surprise you as a guy who trained as a soldier for weekends for all those years that it's taking these guys so long to figure out what their responsibilities are going to be so that we can leave their country to them?
Yeah, it's also, you know, pretty frustrating, but I think the guys who are there now on the ground, the guys who I know, who I've spoken to, who, you know, have taken over the mission that I had, essentially, a lot of focus is going into training these guys up because they're slowly realizing it's imperative. It's, you know, it's paramount that these guys get trained up and are able to do their own police work and do their own defense of their nation, because we can't be there forever. And I think it's frustrating to me that it's taking as long as it has. But what else can you do? They need to be able to hold their own.
Yeah. Now, we talked about you being there with your laptop and blogging and emailing back and forth to people who I'm sure here in the States were telling you what they were seeing in the media and the news coverage of the war. When you're in a war, you obviously have a different perspective than those of us who have not been to war. How much do you think that the media got wrong? How much do you think it got right?
This is always a difficult question. It's a very common question, I think, soldiers get asked when they come back. And the first thing that I want to tell people is, you know, you're asking me about a forest. Okay, yeah, I was in the forest. I can tell you all about the tree that I stood next to for a year, but I can't tell you much about the forest itself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, you know, people say, well, did the media, you know, the media's got this liberal bias. Was it really as bad as the media said? And I think, well, how many times do you have to see dead kids before it's like that bad? It's like, yeah, in a sense, it's combat, it's war. Yeah, it's pretty bad. I don't know how the media got it, because you know what? I wasn't in the U.S. watching the media. I was on the ground actually kind of doing it. For me, yeah, it was pretty bad, but I guess it's really all relative. If you want to compare to, say, you know, the Vietnam War or something, no, it wasn't that bad. But if you compare it to something, you know, more black and white, say maybe World War II, in a lot of ways, yeah, it is pretty bad. So it's really, I hate to give an ambiguous answer like that, but it's kind of a matter of perspective. Yes, in some ways it was very bad, in other ways, no, it wasn't that bad.
Yeah, and I'm sure that there were days for you where that day, Tuesday, was absolute hell, a horrible, horrible day, and then Wednesday, you lived, and you didn't have to fight anybody, and nothing blew up. That's a great day.
Yeah, those are great days. I mean, how many dead friends do you have to have before you can say, yeah, it was pretty bad? You know, just, we lost guys while we were there, and that's, you know, there's a lot of guys going to say, yeah, it was... I got dead friends, so my answer to that question is, yeah, it was pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the forest for the trees tunnel vision, mm-hmm. Again, I've never been at war. So when you're in combat, do you have any idea what's going on in the periphery, or are you just focused on what you're doing? And the second part of the question is do you care?
That's actually a good question. First part of the question, yes, you're very focused on what you're doing, and that's a pretty natural response as a human being because it's a matter of survival. What matters to me most is protecting my own life and protecting other soldiers whom I'm with, and everything else kind of takes a back seat. You know, I get asked a lot of questions, and a lot of political questions. Well, how do soldiers feel about this and that? Well, you know what? When you're there, those things are so completely irrelevant because they're not important to survival. So, I mean, a good way of putting it is, yeah, in a lot of ways, soldiers simply don't care. If you try to press a soldier and ask him a question, like, how do you feel about this or that, he'll probably try to give you an answer, or try his best to give you a straight answer, maybe the answer you want to hear, but you can't, an effective soldier is not going to be concerned with those things in combat. He's going to be concerned about the tactical environment in which he's in and nothing else.
I'm talking with Jason Hartley. The book is called Just Another Soldier, based on entries that he put on his blog, justanothersoldier.com, before going off to war in 2003 and then spending 11 months in the Sunni Triangle in Iraq. We'll take a break and come back with more here on the Paul Harris Show. It's News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking with Jason Hartley, whose book is called Just Another Soldier, A Year on the Ground in Iraq. He went into active duty in Iraq in 2003, spent 11 months in the Sunni Triangle, that after 13 years as a weekend warrior in the Army National Guard. Jason, do we have too many guardsmen and reserves over there and not enough regular Army?
Well, you definitely have a lot of guardsmen over there and a lot of guys that thought they would never get deployed to being over there, but I think we're spread pretty thin over there. Pretty much any soldiers you could throw over there right now would be good.
Were you surprised to find yourself at war, and did you want to be in a war?
Well, I'm an infantryman, so the easy answer to that question is, yeah, I wanted to go to war because it's what I've trained to do for 14 years. But was it something that I and the guys that I was with that we thought we'd ever do? No. I mean, the last time that infantrymen had been deployed to combat was the Korean War. So we thought at best, as guardsmen, maybe we'll like sandbag a flood someday or something or whatever and perform our civic duty. But yeah, it was before 9/11, we would never have thought we'd be deployed anywhere as infantrymen.
Although after 9/11, you were deployed at JFK Airport doing M16 standstill duty, weren't you?
Oh yeah, I was an M16 window model for 8 months.
Explain what that means.
Well, for 8 months, we stood at John F. Kennedy Airport, essentially providing security. We're watching the security process of people going through the metal detectors and so forth. And it was, I guess you can get different answers depending on who you ask, like what was the purpose of the soldiers being there. But, you know, it was, to be maybe perhaps a bit cynical about it, it was window dressing, basically. We're just sort of there providing whatever, making some people nervous and other people safe. Depending on who you ask.
Making them feel safe, even if you weren't actually increasing security or weren't needed to increase security. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose my feelings on that is, all I know is you don't really have many guns in an airport. Now I'm standing there with an assault rifle. What am I going to do? Shoot a terrorist? It's an M16. The bullet is made to penetrate. I could shoot one bullet. It's going to hit five people if I actually had it. To me, it seemed kind of silly, but whatever. I was happy. I was proud to perform the duties that I was asked to perform, and that was what I was asked to do, so I did it.
You also say in the book that while standing there for 8 hours a day at a security checkpoint, you notice that there is one surefire way to get anything through security.
Yeah, a woman with large breasts, pretty much. Everyone there was running security as soldiers and cops, and that's all we're doing is watching people all day. And if you wanted to get something through an airport, just have someone there with a girl is coquette would be a good way of describing a girl that could.
A lot of cleavage helps, is what you're saying.
Yeah, a lot of cleavage, and it ends up becoming a pretty big distraction. That was always kind of an interesting dilemma when people came through, with so much focus was on girls, but it's because we're all guys, and you know, we're bored.
Now, speaking of boredom, I got to ask you about Camp Chili. What is that?
Well, when soldiers who are deployed to Iraq are able to go on a four-day pass, there's two places they might be sent, one of which was in the country of Qatar, and it had a name that, I can't remember how the hell to pronounce it, but essentially we just call it Camp Chili's, because there was a Chili's restaurant in the center of this camp, and it was kind of funny, that almost seemed as though things were built around this Chili's restaurant as if it were like the command center or something. It had a brick wall around, and it's like 20-high-foot, like, you know, barbed wire fence. And that was just kind of a joke, is that it was, Camp Chili's, and that was like the nerve center, the bat cave was underneath, you know, the freezer room or whatever.
Yeah, and you were able to go there on leave, an R&R?
Yeah, it was an R&R spot, which basically what it came down to is the same thing. It's like it was like one of the only opportunities the guys had to interact with girls, if you take my meaning.
Yeah.
And that kind of really became the focus of whenever guys were sent on pass to Camp Chili.
Who were the women you were dealing with there? Were they Qatari women, or were they members of the U.S. military?
No, it was all U.S. military. It was security was a bit tight while we were there, and there was a very limited number of soldiers were able to actually go off post. And even when you could, just by nature of the culture, this was not Vietnam. There was no, like, you know, me love you long time kind of thing. It's very difficult to interact with local women. So all the interactions on that level it was always between male and female soldiers.
Now, the Salt Lake Tribune in Salt Lake City, Utah, came out with a report about a week and a half ago that says that sex is rampant among the men and women in uniform serving in Iraq.
Yeah, and in other news, water is wet.
Well, I think a lot of people were surprised to find out how much was going on there, particularly because in your book you say women shouldn't even be there in the first place.
Well, I state that I don't think that women should be in combat arms units, particularly in the infantry. And whatever, I'm biased. I've been in the infantry for pretty much my entire career. Now, women in combat, I'm all about integration, and I believe that things should be very egalitarian, especially when it comes to the genders. But it's sometimes hard to make those arguments in a combat zone, because having women there really changes the dynamic, and not really for, like, because they're women, or maybe they can't hold their weight, or they naturally don't have an instinct to kill, or not even any of those arguments, just because as soon as you introduce women to an environment that's prevalently, you know, macho and all guys, everyone wants to hook up, and a lot of the job discipline goes completely out the window. I would say that's the main reason why it's difficult to have women in situations like that. It's not because the women are doing anything wrong. It's just because the focus becomes, and it's just people, like, they don't want to talk about this because it seems so, you know, I don't know, like, inappropriate. But every soldier that I've ever met, their first priority is sex, and everything else, patriotism, wanting to fight, do a good job, be a square away soldier, is unfortunately it always kind of takes second place. I mean, people are going to hate me for saying that, but that's the God's honest truth if you talk to a soldier one-on-one.
And as this Salt Lake Tribune story pointed out, you go to any military base in this country and they're selling lingerie, and medics are handing out condoms in Iraq, and there are pregnancy test kits available and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, you got boys with boys' parts and girls with girls' parts, and they like to find each other, don't they? Yeah.
They do. And in an environment like that, for some reason, and there's probably some, like, psychological explanation to it, almost seems like it becomes kind of, like, more important. Like, you know, I could die tomorrow and I need to, like, spread my seed. So, like, I need to, like, you know, it becomes exceptionally important on a very kind of, like, base level.
Absolutely understood. And by the way, the last point here on women serving in at least the infantry, you say in the book that men are better at it because women have something men don't have, which is the common sense gene. What does that mean?
Well, I've noticed in the time that I've been in the Army is that when you have a group of guys together, you can convince a male soldier to do anything. I've seen soldiers train on numerous occasions to the point of their death. I've seen soldiers die in training because they push themselves so hard that they expire or get brain damage from heat stroke or whatever. In the times that I've trained with women, they seem to have this kind of like common sense gene will kick in, and let's say, no, okay, I want to be a good soldier, but this is absurd. I'm not going to kill myself in training.
Mm.
Guys will kill themselves in training, but that's kind of the benefit of the military, is it's that peer pressure, that macho peer pressure is one of the most powerful training tools that the military has. And it's, you know, women just kind of, in my experience, have always had a lot more common sense, and they won't kill themselves in training.
The book is called Just Another Soldier, A Year on the Ground in Iraq, based on Jason Hartley's blog while serving in uniform. JustAnotherSoldier.com is the blog website. We'll come back and talk some more in a moment here as the Paul Harris Show continues on KMOX. Talking with Jason Hartley, who spent 11 months in the Sunni Triangle as a member of the infantry. He's a member of the New York Army National Guard, 13 years as a weekend warrior, then called up for duty in 2003, fought the war in Iraq and in the streets of Iraq in particular, and writes about that experience in a book called Just Another Soldier, A Year on the Ground in Iraq. While you were there, did you get friendly with any Iraqis, Jason?
To a limited extent, I suppose. We worked with the Iraqi National Guard quite a bit. They would come along with us on a lot of missions, and so we were always kind of seeing the same guys. So we kind of got to know a good number of them in that capacity, and we got to know a lot of the kids in town. They didn't have much to do, and they'd spend a lot of time on the streets, and they had a lot of, like, black market swag that they liked to sell us, like knives and so forth. And some of the kids we got to know. But it was pretty much just them, some of the kids and then some of the ING guys.
Did you ever know who to trust?
That always became a bit tricky, because you could have guys, you really have to learn to kind of like trust your gut. There's some guys we felt as though we could trust for the most part, and then there's others that you always had to keep an eye on. Like a lot of the local interpreters that we would use would be great assets to us, because, you know, interpreters were at such a, you know, we didn't have enough of them, and sometimes these guys would get a little bit kind of too big for their boots and think that David would be an asset for the insurgency, and sometimes they would flip sides, and, you know, sometimes we had to watch the Iraqi police because we could never know really where their loyalties were. Pretty much what it came down to, and this might sound kind of cynical, but anyone we were handing, like, large wads of cash to, like maybe to fix, say, water treatment facilities or to help, you know, build some stuff for the school, they always liked us because we were good for business. But that also created a lot of resentment among other locals or maybe other, say, police officers or somebody, and that was always one of the most difficult parts, is trying to figure out who could we trust, who was friends, what are their loyalties today, because sometimes loyalties would shift depending on, you know, the political environment. And it makes fighting and, you know, doing police work essentially over there exceptionally difficult.
What do you think of this FX show over there?
You know, I haven't watched a single episode. I can't bring myself to do it. And a lot of my friends have watched it. I mean, I don't want to rag on Stephen Bochco, but I don't know one person who's been to Iraq who thinks that show is anything other than garbage.
Are you not watching it because you think it's garbage or because you don't want to relive it?
You know, it would be really wimpy of me to say I don't want to relive it, but that's probably a part of it. But really, I don't have an interest in it. I can't imagine. I don't want to watch that show and see the same unit, like, getting firefights every day. Like, oh, wow, so why is it always the same guy? Is it all the drama? I mean, I've seen some of the commercials. It's just like, man, it's not dramatic like that. I can't watch it.
There's an entry from your blog and your book, May 7th, 2004. All I ever needed to know about combat, I learned playing Doom.
Yeah.
And the movie Doom was number one at the box office this weekend, so I got to ask you, really?
Yeah, you know what? I say that kind of tongue in cheek, but not really. Because any kid my age or younger who has played a lot of these, like, first-person shooter-type games, you learn certain tactics that are really good practice for what we do. A lot of the work that we did while in Iraq was room clearing, which essentially means raiding homes or buildings, going from room to room, securing, you know, a built-up urban environment. And it's the exact same thing you do when you play games like Doom. And there was many times I found myself like, I'm playing a big video game right now, and this is not bad because I've practiced these tactics and these procedures extensively just goofing off playing video games.
Did you get the same adrenaline rush pulling the trigger on an M16 or a real weapon that you would do pulling the trigger on a joystick or a video game?
Well, obviously it's a lot bigger doing it with a real rifle. It's an experience that's, I mean, the closest analogous thing to it is perhaps sex, but it's... Honestly, it's a little bit, it's similar. I mean, the difference is huge, but still it's the same kind of, I mean, when you're in combat, it's anyone who says it's not a game is just taking themselves too seriously. It is essentially a game. It's a dangerous one, but it's the same, you know, it's a lot of game theory involved in what you're doing. And I mean, for generations like me, we're playing a lot of video games. It's kind of a, we're already sort of comfortable with the environment mentally.
And the idea of the game is to live and then go off on leave. And we haven't talked about a lot of the harsh stuff of war. People can read your book if they want to know more about what combat is really like. But I'd like to leave today with a story from the book about you and the U.S. Embassy and Barbados. Why were you there and what happened?
Yeah, I had it was kind of an interesting thing. I went on leave. Most guys go back to the States for leave. I wanted to go somewhere random, and I didn't want to see family. So I chose Barbados arbitrarily because it had a funny name. When I got there, I don't have a passport. I've never really traveled. I'm not a world traveler kind of guy. So, but I read that I didn't need a passport to go to Barbados. So the Army gave me a ticket to go there, which was one of the coolest things the U.S. Army has ever done for me. They gave me a ticket there with no questions asked.
Uh-huh.
And I had a fine time. Then I decided I wanted to go to another island in the Caribbean. But then when I went to the airport, they, you know, they asked for my passport. And I said, well, I don't have a passport, but here's, like, my military ID. And they basically laughed at me and said, they explained to me that I needed a passport for me to go to the next island. So I went to the embassy to try to get some emergency travel orders or, like, a temporary passport. And it was kind of cool. I was treated like a king showing up with a military ID. People treated me very well. It was like a church in there. Everyone who's trying to get, you know, green cards to come to the U.S., but that being given the VIP treatment ended as soon as I had to speak to the woman explaining why I was in the country, why I wanted to leave, and why I didn't have a passport. And she really grilled me. You know, she asked, like, how can you not have a passport? How did you get to Iraq? You had to fly there, right? You probably flew through other countries. How could you possibly have gone to, like, Sicily and Italy or Germany on your way there and not have a passport? It makes no sense to me. And I'm telling her, well, like, look, here's the answer to your question. Okay, how does the U.S. Army invade a sovereign nation without the blessing of the U.N.? Well, answer, the U.S. Army does pretty much whatever it wants. and, you know, as she, 5 minutes later, I walked out of that embassy with a passport good for a year.
Unbelievable. One of the great stories from the book, Just Another Soldier, A Year on the Ground in Iraq. The website is justanothersoldier.com. The book is online, you know, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and in your local bookstore as well. It's a terrific read. Jason, thanks for your time today.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Jason Hartley on the Paul Harris Show. It's News Talk 1120 KMOX.